You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is James Corbett, publisher of the CorbettReport.com and editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He's speaking to us from Japan, where he's worked and lived since 2004. Welcome back to the show, James.
Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here.
The Japanese Prime Minister called a snap election. He won. Was that a surprise?
It wasn't so much of a surprise. I don't think anyone was expecting that Abe was going to lose this election, or more accurately, his LDP party was going to lose the election. But there was some drama in this election because there was a rising third party, if you will, called Japan, I believe, the Party of Hope, Kibo no To. It was a brand new party that was created by a popular politician here, a Tokyo governor, Yuriko Koike, which was creating a bit of a stir and throwing something new into the mix, because generally speaking, elections here are a contest between the ruling LDP party and the opposition party, which is the DPJ. And the DPJ has only been in power twice, I believe, in the past 60 years. So it's never really that much of a contest. Here was this new party that had a bit of hype and drama surrounding it. And so there was that interesting thing being thrown in the mix. But ultimately, what ended up happening is that there was some interest in this new party. And unfortunately, most of that seemed to just be filtered from the opposition party's support base. So what you had was a split opposition, which meant that Abe and the LDP basically swept the election. It was even more of a crushing defeat for the DPJ than usual. So what ultimately ended up happening here is that the ruling party, led by Prime Minister Abe, now has an even more sweeping mandate than they did before to continue business as usual, which means economically plowing ahead with Abenomics, which has been such a great thing for the economy over the last 5 years, right? Well, maybe it'll work in the next couple of years. Politically, this also means that Abe has some sort of mandate to go ahead with the constitutional reforms that he's looking at to try to make Japan into a more militaristic country.
That would allow Japan's armies to go overseas, wouldn't it?
That's right. Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that was drafted up during the American occupation after World War II specifically prohibits Japan from having offensive military forces. So what Japan has is a self-defense force, the SDF, which is a military in all but name. In fact, one of the largest militaries on the planet, an exceptionally well-funded one. But it is not an offensive military force, at least not on paper, so it cannot be deployed for offensive military missions. It can only be deployed in defense. Now, some recent interpretations of that Article 9 have reinterpreted that law to mean, well, yeah, but we can send forces around the world to help defend or in the possible defense of some of our allies. So they've started stretching that already. But there is talk of actual reform of Article 9 itself, to the extent of perhaps even making an offensive military force possible in Japan, which obviously is a pretty important question with not only North Korea, but obviously a rising China being on the table politically very much here in Japan.
Well, I would say with North Korea firing missiles over top of Japan right now, if the call comes to a physical conflict with North Korea, would Japan be willing to put troops in there to help out any efforts by South Korea and the U.S.?
One could imagine a scenario like that playing out, but as we've talked about before, there really doesn't seem to be any military solution possible to this problem, precisely because any sort of military response to North Korea is going to lead to a retaliation strike that will affect millions of people there in Seoul, just miles away from the DMZ. So it really doesn't seem that there is a plausible military solution to this. Anything that happens on the Korean Peninsula, though, is obviously going to involve Japan in some way, just by sheer proximity. So it's certainly possible to imagine a future in which Japanese self-defense forces have some part to play in what's happening in the Korea situation.
We'll have more with James Corbett right after the break. Welcome back. We're speaking with James Corbett, a coronation of sorts happened in China with the communist, committee getting together and basically giving the president the same status as Mao Zedong.
That's right. It's hard to understate the importance of what's just taken place in Beijing. It's a very important thing. This was the 19th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. So officially, what this just happened in Beijing was the National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party. It takes place twice a decade, once every 5 years. And this is the Communist Party specifically, which theoretically, technically, is not the same as the Chinese government. This is the Chinese Communist Party's twice a decade shindig. So what they were doing was getting together, as they do every 5 years, to, amongst other things, select the party's Politburo, which is a 25-member committee, which then appoints or then elects a 7-member central committee, which is really the top party leadership. And yes, one of the effects of this 19th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party was a quite dramatic shakeup of that core Politburo, the top leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. Obviously, President Xi Jinping retains his position, as does his premier, Li Keqiang. But the other 5 members of that 7-member committee all were retired, shall we say. They were not reelected, and they were replaced by 5 new members. This is important because this was widely expected to happen and widely seen as a further consolidation of President Xi's power over China generally and the Communist Party specifically. And in fact, he has not appointed a successor on this Politburo, which is interesting because the presidential term in China is for 10 years or a maximum of 10 years. This will be his second 5-year term, i.e. after this 5-year term is up in 2022 when they have the 20th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, President Xi should be stepping down, but no successor has been named yet. So there is speculation that he may be trying to set up something where he retains power even after his 10-year limit, which is an interesting development. And there are a number of other things that have come out from this meeting, including, economically speaking, there is some fallout from his gigantic marathon 3.5-hour speech that President Xi opened this National Congress with, where he laid out the 14 principles of the Xi Jinping thought, specifically the Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. And yes, that is an actual technical term for this Xi Jinping thought, which they are apparently going to enshrine in the Chinese Communist Party constitution now, as you say, putting him on par with Mao Zedong as someone who's actually specifically mentioned in that constitution. But the number one principle is ensuring party leadership over all work, i.e. the Chinese Communist Party is going to be the boss of everyone. Of course, they already, in a way, kind of are. But it is a chilling thing to be putting in black and white like that. And people are reading this to mean that the sort of takeover of various organizations and various industries, including specifically the tech industry, which to some extent has some arm's length distance from the government, well, that arm's length may be being closed up fairly soon. So people are expecting that. Economically speaking, the fallout from this so far, the Shanghai Composite Index rose 0.26% yesterday to close at a year-to-date high, showing that there's some limited lackluster enthusiasm for this new Politburo that's been announced. But longer term, it's likely that the Chinese government is going to start slashing on infrastructure investment and overcapacity in Chinese plants. So there is a potential, anyway, for an economic slowdown next year as a result of all this fallout.
Some people have thought, with so-called free enterprise being allowed in China, that it could lead to democracy. Does this kind of set that back?
I think there should be no doubt in anyone's mind that democracy is not on the on the agenda for the Chinese Communist Party. And we see that quite clearly. As you say, I think people have seen the rise of netizens and the internet effect in China as a potential flowering of some sort of democracy. online at least. But that's been, they've been cracking down on that quite strictly over the last several months specifically. There's this online media purification purge that's been taking place, trying to rid China of various websites that hitherto have been used for sharing for international media, Japanese anime or American movies or that sort of thing. There's been a crackdown, so now it's only really a party-approved Chinese content that's available in these online sites. And there's been more and more of a crackdown on Weibo and these other, you know, Twitter-like and social media, Chinese social media engines that have been, to some extent, a place where some form of free discussion or freer discussion has been taking place. There's been more crackdown on that. And as I say, people are looking more at the possibility of the Chinese government basically stepping in and taking more formal control over the tech industry, including all of those sites where freer discussion have been taking place.
Will this mean more documentaries about Dr. Bethune, the Canadian doctor who helped out the Chinese Revolution and helped so many of their wounded troops?
It's certainly possible. It's interesting to see the Western media perspective on all of this. And as people have pointed out, for example, the New York Times has a series on the Chinese century, as they're calling it, looking at the development of China over the past, well, almost a century, the Chinese communist the regime, that is, and noting that in that database of articles grouped under that in New York Times, there isn't a single mention of Mao's disastrous, horrific Great Leap Forward, which of course was the death of millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of people who starved as a result of that Great Leap Forward. Not a single mention in the New York Times. I think there's a very interesting relationship that's developing in the Western world generally, as reflected through the Western media, where there's somewhat of a reserved cheerleading going on right now for China and what's happening, because China really is an important part of economic global growth, and I think no one wants to rock that boat and spoil the eggs, as it were, of economic benefit that can be reaped from allying oneself with this regime.
Hong Kong and Singapore's central banks have signed a financial deal based on blockchain technology. Are they trying to become a new kind of trading bloc?
Well, one of the fallouts from this this National Congress that just took place was an interesting line from Xi Jinping's 3.5-hour speech, where he said, "We will continue to support Hong Kong and Macau in integrating their own development into the overall development of the country." And a lot has been read into that, but Pepe Escobar for the Asia Times, for example, has pointed out what this really means is that Beijing is looking to use Hong Kong as the financial hub for their Belt and Road Initiative, this great trillion-dollar ideal of connecting all of these parts of Central Asia and Eurasia and Europe together with China in this great trading bloc through land and sea routes. Basically, they're looking to use Hong Kong, which has a convertible currency and capital mobility and relative financial freedom, as the financial hub for this Belt and Road Initiative. And Hong Kongers are a little bit more wary of that. Another interesting step that's taken place as a result of this National Congress, Shanghai, which operates a free trade zone, kind of an experimental zone where imports and exports are handled with less care, shall we say, from the Chinese sticky-fingered government, they've announced plans to actually make that free trade zone into a free trade port to ease restrictions on incoming cargo. So we've seen stocks in a variety of Shanghai businesses, including the Shanghai International Port Group and Shanghai Waigao Chao Free Trade Zone Group Company, have been surging as a result of this. So there is some indication that there may even be some pockets in China where they're going to attempt to use those pockets as sort of outlets to the wider world, economically speaking.
We'll have more with James Corbett right after this. Welcome back. We're chatting with James Corbett. James, what are you hearing about the Las Vegas shooting?
I'm hearing a lot of things, and I'm hearing not a lot of information about what this the shooter, the person who's been identified as the shooter, Stephen Paddock, what on earth the motivation for this was. let alone all of the reports that have come in about there was multiple shooters and this side of thing. There's been so many different conflicting reports about this that it's difficult to get a handle on. Probably the most interesting aspect of this story, as people know, is the security guard who was shot before after the shooting, depending on what timeline we're talking about on what day, and his story and the fact that he's not doing interviews anymore. He went on Ellen with a handler to talk about what happened, but without answering any questions about the timeline.
Ooh, Ellen apparently will make him, I was going to say Ellen will make him dance, but I don't know if she'll make him answer any tough questions.
Exactly. Not dancing in the appropriate way, I think. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So there's a lot of question marks surrounding this and not a lot of answers at this point. And I think just given the fact that there has been so many conflicting timelines given out about this event so far, should be a big flag to the general public who's interested in knowing more about this event, why the authorities can't even get their own timeline straight.
Have you heard about possible witnesses suffering mysterious deaths, otherwise healthy people, and people having their cell phones and tablets returned, being blanked by the FBI?
I've heard reports of that. I haven't personally looked into them, so I can't confirm anything on that side. But I have heard of, for example, a witness who was attesting to secondary shooters who ended up dying. There was also that interesting report that was floating around at the time of the event, that there was someone who was interviewed in just the hour or two after the event on national TV who said that there was someone who came around saying, "You're all going to die tonight," before the shooting happened, which was an interesting part of the story that seems to be forgotten. So there's a lot of very, very big questions surrounding this right now.
What have you heard about the Hillary Clinton Russian uranium connection?
Well, this is an interesting story. Perhaps the most interesting part of it is that you don't hear a peep about this in NBC or CBS or any of the other outlets that have been talking about the Trump-Russia connections ad nauseum for the last several months. But suddenly there's this pretty important connection about the uranium deal with Russia and the potential ties to the Clinton Foundation. You're not hearing very much about that. So for people who don't know, there was a uranium deal with Russia that took place during the Obama administration, that took place with Clinton help and Obama administration knowledge in a time period. And I don't have the details in front of me, but there was something like a substantial contribution that was made by Russians to the Clinton Foundation right before this deal went ahead. So it's a very important story, one that would seem to point quite directly to collaboration with Russia, but it doesn't point to Trump collaboration with Russia. It points to the exact opposite, Clinton collaboration with Russia. So it is not being reported on very well at all in a lot of the same outlets that would be reporting on this story if it was to do with Trump.
Do you think Russian TV is reporting on it?
Well, of course, yes. I mean, one has to understand that there is a Russian direct Kremlin-funded international television presence in the form of RT, and they certainly have been reporting on this story, and for obvious reasons. But, of course, the same people who will point out the Kremlin links to Russia will downplay, for example, the BBC links to the British government. Oh, that's different. The BBC is a different thing than RT. So I think there's a lot of hypocrisy to go around on issues like these that people don't generally want to advertise.
Well, so far, James, we're allowed to talk about stuff like this, but we don't have multi-billion dollar budgets to promote ourselves.
Sadly not. I am completely the listener supported, and I know that you guys are not sitting on piles of cash either. Unfortunately, when people talk about real information from a real independent perspective, there isn't heaps of money to be made in that. But at any rate, we'll keep plowing forward with it.
Yes, we keep chirping away. James, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me on.
My guest has been James Corbett, publisher of thecorbettreport.com and editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He was speaking to us from Japan. You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio. Find us on Twitter at Talk Digital Net. Our popular YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Questions for the show or our guests can be sent to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thanks for listening.